we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. Earlier this year, we ran a competition for young people aged 15 to 21 who had one great idea related to the beauty and complexity of Christian faith in the world we live in. They had to pitch us their ideas and send in a short audio recording. And the person who submitted the best entry would then work with us to produce their story for Life and Faith. At the end of the competition, one person really stood out to us as the clear winner.
What does it mean to live with one identity in the growing secularism of a city like Sydney? You see, these are things that I've been pondering over the last few years as a young medical student starting out a career which seeks to provide holistic care to individuals, covering the emotional, the physical, the mental, and also the spiritual aspects of their health. In a society where you are asked to compartmentalize your life, leave faith in the church, leave your private life at home, and simply bring your professional skills into the workplace. In that kind of context, how can we live with one identity?
That's from the audio recording sent in by Shadi Hanna, who is in his fourth year studying medicine at the University of New South Wales. We immediately thought Shadi was onto something. And so for the past couple of months, the CPX team has been working with him to produce this special episode, which is, in fact, our 300th episode of Life and Faith. The shape of Shadi's episode has changed a little bit since his original pitch, and the key questions he's come to address are, how important is it for doctors to practice medicine holistically? And especially, what is the place of spirituality in healthcare? So, without further ado, I'll hand you over to Shadi to help shed some light on the topic of medicine and spirituality.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Shadi Hanna. I remember vividly sitting in a lecture one day, about midway through my third year of studying medicine, looking at important factors to consider in end-of-life care. The lecturer was working through slides, statistics, clinical medicine, all that kind of stuff. But then he came to this one slide, which I just found fascinating. It was a table titled, Attributes Rated as Important by More Than 70% of Patients, but Not Physicians. Now, whenever you see a mismatch in what patients think is important and what doctors think patients think is important, it always reveals some areas where the medical community might be a little bit short-sighted. On the slide were 8 attributes. There were practical things like having funeral arrangement plans and social things like not being a burden to family or society and being able to help others. And there were also 2 spiritual attributes, being at peace with God and prayer. 89% of respondents saw being at peace with God as important, and 85% felt that way about prayer. But the percentage of doctors who saw these things as important was significantly less. Why is this? I believe it's to do with the predominant worldview of the Western doctor, which is deeply rooted in the assumption that every disease has a physical cause requiring a physically based treatment. In practice, this often means there's a void between the physical and the spiritual, between facts and values, between the rational and emotional.
Very often, what a patient needs is someone to talk to about what they now have to face. My wife works as a nurse, and so she reminds me of this. What somebody really needs is a blanket because they're cold, or a cup of tea because there's something about tea which is magical. And we often devalue that and think that the medical interventions are the key things, and I'm not persuaded that's actually right.
That's the Reverend Dr. Andrew Sloan, a lecturer in Old Testament and Christian thought at Morling College in Sydney. Andrew studied medicine and practiced as a doctor for a bit before moving into theology. And in 2016, he published a book called Vulnerability in Care, Christian Reflections on the Philosophy of Medicine. Natasha and I sat down with Andrew to talk about how he sees the place of spirituality in medicine. But first, we asked him a question that It might seem obvious, but they had quite a surprising answer. What is the goal of medicine?
I'd argue that the key goal of medicine is, simply speaking, to express a community's commitment to care for its vulnerable members. Now, something about human beings is that we are inherently frail and vulnerable. We often like to think otherwise, but the kinds of beings that we are prey to the forces of the universe and the evils of other people. And this can impinge on our lives at any time. And at all times, we are dependent on others. We often like to think that we run our own lives, that we control our own destinies, and that's generally wishful thinking. In fact, we can't get going in the world without other people. We can't keep going in the world without other people. And that expresses something of the inherent dependence of human beings. So there's something inherently frail and vulnerable about human beings, but sometimes that vulnerability is exposed. It seems to me that a well-formed human community does something about that. It doesn't ignore such people, nor does it abandon them to their fate, but it seeks to care for them in such a way as, wherever possible, they can be then included again in the meaningful life of that community.
So does that mean that you talk about medicine being more about care than about cure? I mean, we usually go to the doctor because we want to get better, right? we want to be cured. But you think it's much more than that?
Yes, it's not other than that. Mm-hmm. Cure, I think, is obviously important, but it's a form that care takes rather than an alternative to it. And furthermore, it doesn't exhaust the forms that care ought to take, and particularly care in a medical context. Because very often there's actually nothing you can do to cure somebody. Sometimes the best a doctor can do is enable them to function well with whatever it is that they now live with. A trivial, well, kind of maybe not so trivial if you've ever had it, relatively trivial example is back pain. There's some really interesting work that's been done in back pain which indicates that the more you investigate it, the worse the outcomes are for most people. That the best thing to do, in fact, is to help people understand what it is about their posture, their behaviour, their stress levels and so on contributes to back pain, and to help them manage that so as to either reduce or remove the back pain or just to enable them to function well with it. And surgery and the like tends to give very poor outcomes. It's in some ways surprising that it's taken us so long to figure that out, mm-hmm. in one sense, but it's not surprising because we think that medicine's about cure. So you find where in the x-ray something's gone wrong and you fix that problem on the x-ray. And only now are we really seeing that fixing the problem on the x-ray often worsens people's lives. So if we think about cure, in scare quotes really, in the context of care, then it both enables us to understand its proper role, but also to understand when that's not the primary thing we ought to be concerned about. And even when it is, we're concerned about it not because that's important in itself, but because it enables people to function well as human beings in their relationships, in the communities, and for the tasks that they find themselves facing.
How does putting care at the centre actually change the dynamics of how medicine is practiced?
That's a good question. Perhaps the best way to answer that is to look at a set of practices where I think, as I understand it, this is done quite well indeed, and that's generally in palliative care. So one of the things about palliative care is that the palliative care physician is understood as part of a team. Often they're the team leader, but not always. And as part of a team, there's a bunch of other people and a bunch of other areas of expertise that are brought to bear in caring for this person. And in a palliative care context, it may well be that the medical concerns are the second or third or fourth set of concerns that need to be addressed, and that it might be concerns about how the family is operating. It might be concerns about what kinds of tasks this person wants to complete. They might have projects that they want to do before they die, what have you. But what happens is that there's a sense of partnership and team. When it goes well, doesn't always, of course. And so that means that there's almost a dance where somebody else comes to the centre of the stage and others are their supporting players. It seems to me that that's quite a helpful model.
Is that because, I mean, palliative care doctors are by definition not seeking to cure, Like, that's kind of off the table. That's why they're there. Yeah. Do you think that makes a difference to how, like, that kind of frees them up to think about this more holistically?
Yep, I think that's part of it. If you think about the kind of people who end up practicing palliative care, they're pretty special people. If they're the kinds of people who see themselves as getting in, fixing a problem and getting out again, then they're not going to do palliative care. Yep. So the kinds of people who are involved are the kinds of people who have, I think, both virtues and skills and perspectives which almost require them to shift how they see what they're about. But also, as you say, not focusing on cure, I think, is a crucial part of it. And recognizing then that in the support that needs to be offered to somebody, it may not be that the doctoral support, so to speak, that medical support is what's needed at this point.
In palliative care contexts, where the goal is really to help people die well, holistic care seems to get more traction. In the rest of the medical world, maybe less so. Quick fixes and clear measurable health outcomes are often the focus instead. And you can understand why. Andrew explained to us a bit about how he thinks we got here and why it can be problematic.
Modern medicine, medicine over the last 100 years or so, has been inordinately successful, extraordinarily successful in dealing with conditions that previously people just had to live with or die of. The range of things that can now be treated is extraordinary. And much of that has been the result of technological advances and advances in technique. Those techniques have been very effective indeed. The problem then becomes that medicos come to think that it's the techniques that matter. When you connect that in with a commodification of medicine, so medicine comes to be seen as another, effectively another consumer product, and people see themselves as consumers who purchase those commodities, and so what they want is the best bang for their buck. Coupled with that is, I think, a desire from governments to use a community's resources well. That's a good thing. I think the efficient use of community resources, including economic resources, is a good thing. The question is, what are the outcomes that those particular resources are meant to maximise? If those outcomes are defined in health terms, then what a government wants is the most efficient use of these medical resources to maximise particular health outcomes. When you bring those two things together, then I think you get a devaluing of medicine as a profession, a redefining of the relationship as one between service provider and client, and a focus on measurable outcomes, either measurable outcomes that a government can write up in a report or measurable outcomes that a client can tick off from their list of desirables. That, I think, is deeply problematic for so many reasons. One reason is, now, I'm old and I'm old-fashioned in this regard, I think. I think there's something lost when we stop talking about people who come to doctors as patients. Now, we need to be very, very careful because there's a whole lot of evils associated with medical paternalism, which saw the doctor as the all-wise one to whom these needy people came for the dispensing of wisdom and the fixing of all their ills. That paternalism is happily dying out. And so the language of patient has been associated with those paternalistic approaches to medicine. And that's a shame. Because one of the things about the language is that it comes from, I don't know Latin, but I've been told it comes from a Latin word to receive, to wait. There's something important about the recognition that people go to doctors because they recognise they can't fix this problem themselves. And they go to doctors because they believe that doctors have knowledge, skills, expertise, power that might be brought to bear on this need that the patient has identified. As such, it's not like going to a shop and buying some product. It's not even like going to a plumber to get a new bathroom. There's some fundamental incapacity that this person now faces that they cannot deal with themselves, and they go to a doctor because they believe that the doctor can. What that does is establish a power differential. So one of the things I like about doctor-patient language is it reminds us that there is a power differential inherent in what goes on when someone goes to a doctor. If we ignore that, then the power just goes underground. It's not acknowledged and it's not well disciplined. Whereas if we acknowledge that power, then we recognize that this power always and everywhere is given to people in order to serve the needs of those who need it. And that service may not mean giving the patient what they think they need.
As opposed to the customer is always right.
Correct.
Andrew has some other concerns about this focus on measurable health outcomes as well.
It's relatively easy, we think, to measure physical health outcomes. It's now possible to measure some emotional outcomes. People like to think that they can measure spiritual outcomes. I have grave concerns about that. I'm not sure that it's the kind of thing that can be measured. And I think it's very important that we never think that only the things that can be measured count. We often think if it can't be counted, then it doesn't count. That's just wrong. Most of the things that matter most to us, in fact, are things that can't be counted or measured. Things like love and relationships and a sense that our life has made some kind of contribution to the world, that it's been a valuable thing all in all.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. A vision of medicine as being about cure rather than care and the divorce between physical and spiritual health is typical of the medical profession in Western contexts, like here in Australia. But that's not the case everywhere in the world. Someone who knows a lot about this is Dr. Nadia Lowe. She's a GP from the Central Coast of New South Wales, but she spent the best part of the last decade working in hospitals, clinics and community health programs across Africa, from Zimbabwe to Madagascar, and most recently in Nyida refugee camp in South Sudan. I sat down with Nadia to chat about some of this work and her sense of the place spirituality has or should have in healthcare.
My Christian faith is a really important part of how I practice medicine, and early on as a medical student, it was something really important for me to work out how to integrate my faith into my medical practice, because I was very aware that just fixing a physical ailment potentially doesn't actually look at really the whole issue that is affecting a person. So yeah, I guess as a Christian medical student, I really wanted to work out how to not just look after the outside physical body, but I also wanted to learn how to look after the emotional needs of my patients, the spiritual needs of my patients, and trying to understand those who I was caring for in their social context as well, the cultural context. And in all of those questions that I had, that was a big reason why I started doing some work in the developing world, and whether it be in Zimbabwe or Madagascar or South Sudan, learning how other cultures saw health and how other cultures integrated spiritual things into their illnesses, and how they kind of viewed their illness as not just a physical ailment that needed to be fixed, but also a spiritual condition that needed to be attended to.
Nadia shared with us an example from her early days in Africa of seeing physical and spiritual health integrated well.
Early on, when I was doing trips back and forth from Zimbabwe, I was mentored by a Christian doctor called Dr. Reed. He was actually from New Zealand, and he was doing a lot of work with the HIV-positive teenagers and children. And he'd set up a psychosocial spiritual program called Champions for Life for these children and for the teenagers. And basically he was very involved in their clinical treatment, the medications that they were on and things, but he realized if the emotional and spiritual needs of these children aren't addressed, then they're not going to take their medicines. They're not going to thrive in life because they're dealing with issues of shame and rejection. Many of them were orphans because their parents had died from HIV. And so this program, Champions for Life, that he set up was set up so that these HIV positive children and teenagers could enter community of other children and teenagers who are in a similar condition to them, where they could encourage one another, they could share stories, they could explore faith together. And they saw a really big improvement in these children's physical health as they were brought into community and given opportunities to really do life with other children in similar situations to them, and also be encouraged by their peers not only to take their medicines but to know their identity beyond being a child who is orphaned with HIV. Their identity is someone made in the image of God.
Nadia told us that working in a non-Western context makes it easier to integrate spirituality into healthcare. She shared a couple of reasons for why she thinks that is.
First of all, people over there don't really seem to separate life into boxes. They wouldn't say, oh, my work is in this box, my family life is in this box, my physical health is in this box, my spiritual life or my church is in this box on Sundays. But they see their spirituality flow into all aspects of life. So when they go to hospital, they don't find it unusual to be prayed for. And it seems to flow more naturally as a doctor in that context to offer prayer. And they understand physical health to be very much interrelated with all the spiritual issues. And so I'll always be involving the chaplain in the hospital in South Sudan, for example, to go and talk to patients because I know how important that is and how patients, especially in that context, almost expect and really, really appreciate the spiritual conversations alongside the medical history taking. Another thing in the Eastern developing world context is people don't expect everything to be fixed. Whereas in our context, we will go to extreme measures to fix every little physical ailment. We'll spend so much time and money fixing the physical, and often we just neglect the emotional and spiritual side of things. And we really need to give thanks for Western medicine and how we can do great things to improve people's health and look after them when they're critically unwell. But we also need to learn from those in the developing world context who are more accepting of death as a part of the cycle of life. And we need to learn from them in the way that at that time when somebody's really close to death, we need to pay more attention to the emotional and spiritual side of things rather than trying to fix or prevent death happening.
Maybe the question then, one that might not get asked all that often, is what can Western medical practice learn from the rest of the world?
I've thought of two practical ways that we can transfer some of the things from the developing context into the kind of more Western medicine context. And one thing is really look at our healthcare team and think, I'm not just the individual doctor looking after this patient. Where do I need to involve the psychologist? Where do I need to involve the chaplain? Where do I need to involve all our other allied health professionals? So I think really respecting every member of the treatment team. The other thought is thinking, how can we get our healthcare more into the community and how can we focus more on prevention? And one of the huge gaps we've got in our Western society is that community structure is often broken down. We often live very isolated in our large houses. and we don't have those structures and the supports from community that we used to have hundreds of years ago, where, you know, there's always a grandmother around to hold the newborn baby when the mother needs to do the washing or the dishes and things, or there's always some other ladies around to watch the kids when the lady needs to go to the water point to get water. And being myself a mother at the moment, I see lots of mothers around me struggle psychologically through the period of having young kids and toddlers, and that's because they're not doing life in community like I believe we were created to do. So somehow we need to bring healthcare messages into community and also build stronger community groups and environments for people like young mums or people, you know, our elderly population, to prevent people getting isolated and giving people spaces to talk with one another and share their needs. And I believe we're all created to carry one another's burdens, and in that way we're promoting good health and we're preventing serious health conditions as well.
Something that came across in both Nadia and Andrew's interviews was their strong belief that physical health is often intertwined with social, emotional, and spiritual matters. So if a doctor wants to treat physical problems, they also need to look at what's going on in the rest of the patient's life and refer patients on to other professionals when appropriate.
I think it's really important, again, to recognise the importance of referral. So if the people that doctors are caring for are people, complex human beings who have multiple dimensions to their lives, some of which relate directly to what lies at the centre of medical practice, that is physical and psychological disruption. Others are much more peripheral. But physical and psychological disruption have obvious spiritual consequences, and spiritual disruption has physical consequences. Now, one of the things we know is that when people feel hopeless, their physical well-being suffers. So if hope is connected to spirituality, then spirituality is connected to medicine. That seems obvious to me. If physical disruption can rob people of hope, then again, spirituality is necessarily connected to medicine. But doctors aren't experts in spiritual care. That's not where their primary training is. It ought to be where some of their training is. So it's interesting that spiritual inventories, spiritual histories are part of what some medical schools are now including. And I think that's a great thing. But there, just as a good history might lead a doctor to think, I need to refer this person on, because this physical condition is not one that I can meaningfully care for. Similarly, it may mean that a doctor might suggest that someone talk to a counsellor or a priest or a rabbi or an imam or whomever it happens to be, because it's clear that there's a spiritual component to what they're addressing.
And do you think that medicine is moving in this direction, towards acknowledging the spiritual element to health and integrating that into medical training programs and the way that doctors operate? I imagine there's also some resistance to that in some quarters.
I believe it is being incorporated into some medical curricula. It's often a bolt-on, so it's a little module that people might do. Look, it's better than not doing it at all, but things like spiritual dimension, the moral dimension of medicine, which I think is also fundamental. I think morality is not something that is added to medicine. Medicine is an inherently moral project, if for no other reason than it's an exercise in power for the benefit of someone in need. That makes it moral. Those concerns, I think, ought to be not so much added onto the medical curriculum as they ought to saturate it. It ought to be there from the start, all the way through. if you like to shift metaphor, they should be threads that are woven through the whole of the medical curriculum rather than little patches that are sewn on.
Is there anything that you think modern medicine has to learn from looking at Jesus and the stories that we have about his life? He was a healer, but not kind of in a medical way.
Yeah, very much so. But it's really important to make the point that we ought not to try and identify Jesus as a proto-doctor or doctors as modern Jesuses, because the healings of Jesus were a demonstration of the power of God to do what humans aren't capable of doing. And they were, in fact, I would suggest, best understood as anticipations of the final end to the universe in which all wrongs are put right and all that interferes with human flourishing and the fulfillment of God's purposes are put right. Doctors ain't in that business. But the kinds of concerns that we see in the healings of Jesus, I think, deeply inform how we ought to understand medical practice. So there's a story where a woman comes to Jesus. She has what we'd now call menorrhagia. She's had it for 12 years, if I remember correctly. So she's had ongoing, persistent menstrual bleeding. Now, this is in a particular social context where when a woman was menstruating, she was treated as unclean, which meant that she couldn't be part of the worshipping community. It's also a first century, largely agricultural or agrarian society where physical labour was fundamental to most people's work in the world. And if she was bleeding over 12 years, then it's fairly likely, particularly if she was poor, which is again very likely, she was probably malnourished, she may have been anemic, she would have had disruption to every aspect of her life. She comes up while Jesus is on his way to do something really important, secretly in the crowd, and touches the back of his cloak. She doesn't want anyone to know. There's some interesting reasons for that. She's unclean. So anyone who touches her would also be unclean, would have to go and fix the problem before they could enter into worship. Whole bunch of things going on. She would have been deeply shamed. She didn't want to be recognized. But Jesus turns and says, "I felt power go out from me. Someone touched me." And the disciples go, "Come on, mate." Rough translation. "There are people everywhere. What are you talking about? Of course someone touched you." No, something different has happened. And it's interesting to ask why he did that, because she was actually healed as soon as she touched his garment. So it wasn't making her better. What he does in turning and saying, "Woman, your faith has healed or saved you," is he demonstrates to the people around that this condition, which had isolated and marginalized her for 12 years, no longer afflicted her, so she could now become incorporated into the life of the community again. So what would have been seen by her as a shaming event is in fact a way of her being deeply honored. This tells us, I think, a bunch of things. It tells us that God does give a toss about suffering human bodies. But I think it also shows us that God gives a toss about how we are connected to people around us, the ways in which we are seen, the ways in which various kinds of incapacities isolate and alienate and marginalize us. And God's in the business, as we see in Jesus, of bringing those on the margins, those who are excluded, into the very center of the crowd in order that people might see that these too are important people who have an important role to play in our communities. That, I think, would quite nicely help shape and reshape what medicine is and how it goes about its task.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Our 300th episode was brought to you by our youth podcast competition winner, Shadi Hanna. If you're listening to our podcast for the first time, welcome. Life and Faith is a weekly conversation about the beauty and complexity of belief in the 21st century. To hear more of these conversations, you can subscribe to our podcast. Just type Life and Faith in the search box of your podcast app to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do take a minute to leave us a rating or a review. Let us know what you think of the program, and it helps other people find our show as well. We plan to run our youth competition again next year, and we're hoping for more great entries. If you have any questions about the competition or you want us to personally email you when it goes live, do get in touch with our youth editor, Anna, at youth@publicchristianity.org. Next week.
That is a very traditional way of thinking about what we call Christmas, but has been called Advent, you know, the coming. And through Christian history, it hasn't been all about the first coming of Jesus. All of the traditional prayers and hymns and liturgy surrounding Advent were about both comings, the lowly coming and the glorious coming to judge the world. So you see it in hymns like Once in Royal David City. The first stanza is all about the lowly entry of Jesus into the world, but the last stanza of that carol is all about when he comes in his great glory and we all see him in his true form. So that two horizons, the lowly and the glorious comings of Jesus, is actually what Christmas is meant to be about.